This week on Barbell Shrugged, we interview Doc Parsley, and we talk about sleep, testosterone, and how to optimize your hormones.
Hey, this is Rich Froning. You're listening to Barbell Shrugged. For the video version, go to barbellshrugged.com.
Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Mike Bletzer here with Doug Larson. We have traveled to Austin, Texas to attend the Paleo FX conference and to grab speakers, experts in their field, and talk to them about what they know. Right now, we have in front of us Dr. Kurt Parsley. He is, from what I understand, So Wrong Fitness, if you follow that guy on Twitter or Instagram, he introduced me to Dr. Parsley here, and he said he is an expert on sleep, and you're a former Navy SEAL, so you kind of have a unique perspective on sleep deprivation and burnout and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Can you give us a little bit of your background, like just a short bio?
Yeah. Starting back at the beginning, so I obviously, like we talked about, I was a former SEAL, enlisted SEAL. Did that up until about 94, and then decided to get out and move on, do other things. Eventually decided to become a doctor. Thought originally I was planning on doing something like physical therapy or maybe athletic training or something. I just knew, like, always kind of had a passion for performance, human performance, and athleticism and anatomy and physiology and all that shit was cool to me. So started heading down that route. Decided to become a doctor. I was married already, had kids already, and so going back into the military wasn't the most attractive idea to me because, you've been in the military, like there's some downsides to that. But the idea of like them paying me to go to medical school and having no debt was pretty attractive. And I said, all right, I'll just owe them like 8 years of my life. So I'll go back to the teams and be their doc and everything will be cool.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And the whole time I was in college, I worked at San Diego Sports Medicine Center, which is like the biggest sports medicine center down there. We had like every kind of healthcare professional there that's imaginable. So I really got to sort of figure out what I wanted to do. Sports medicine seemed really cool. Orthopedic surgery seemed even cooler. So I'm like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be an orthopod, right? So,
yeah.
I went to the military's medical school, which is called USHA. It's just is the abbreviation, Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. Just flows off, rolls off your tongue, right? Easy thing to say.
Most things in the military do.
Yeah, all these acronyms in the military. You can't be a military organization without a ridiculous acronym. So I did that, and then the way the military, or the not all branches, but primarily the Navy works, is that you do your first year of residency, your internship year, they call it, and then you have to go out into the fleet and be a regular doctor. And that's the way they can keep general practitioners in the military, right? Because everybody specializes, everybody wants to specialize.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. So you can just like get thrown out there wherever the hell they want to send you, and that's a shorter gig, or you can choose to do dive medicine, you can choose to do flight surgery, and then you go through flight school if you're a flight surgeon, and if you want to do dive medicine, you go through dive school and some specialized hyperbaric training and all this type of stuff, which is what was needed to go back to the SEALs, which was obviously the route that I was going to do. So
yeah,
I went back there. I did the DMO training, is what they call it, UMO training. Actually didn't end up going back to the SEAL teams initially. Went to a submarine rescue unit, did that for a couple of years, and then went to the teams. Got there at like the perfect time, right? Like I still was set on being an orthopedic surgeon. Got there at the perfect time to build the West Coast first sports medicine center. You would never believe this. SEALs have been around for 50 years. We never had a nutritionist, we never had a strength and conditioning coach, we never had like physical therapist, we had one athletic trainer there.
That's shocking.
Who was, mm-hmm. it was a great dude, but he's literally working out of a trailer. Like we had a trailer that he worked out of. So I, perfect timing, it wasn't my initiative, but I got put in charge of it, and I you know, and I helped. I get to be a big contributor to building this great program that we called the Tactical Athlete Program. And there's a sports medicine component and a performance component where you may be familiar with guys like Josh Everett. So he's the sports medicine, or he's the performance guy of it, right? So there's a gym.
Yeah, he programs a lot of their workouts out there.
So there's a gym component of this program, and then there's the sports medicine program, and there's what we call this bridge, which is like right in the middle. So you rehab them, they're not quite ready to go back. You do this bridge where they're kind of in between, and then they send them to the performance. And so it was this great initiative, and like I give props to all the guys who developed it. Like, it was brilliant, perfect, the perfect idea for treating SEALs like professional athletes, right?
Yeah.
The problem was that in building the center, we hired more athletic trainers and physical therapists, had ortho rounds coming through, had sports med docs coming through, had these athletic trainers, had these strength and conditioning coaches, had nutritionists, had exercise physiologists, and now I was the dumbest sports medicine guy around at this point, right? Like, I have the least training of anybody here.
Well, then you should be in charge, I think.
Yeah, so I was in charge.
Yeah, right? That's how it works, right?
So I managed it, right? And so what happened is, the guy from my genre of SEALs and maybe a little younger than me, they would come to the sports medicine center to do their rehab, but then they'd come in my office, shut the door and say, all right, dude, let me tell you what's really going on with me, right? The military, any kind of specialized training, any kind of specialized job, if you don't have if you're not medically cleared, then you lose your job for a while, right? So these guys don't want to admit to a ton of the stuff that's going on. They can't be on certain medications. They can't, right? And then they don't want to be, the SEAL culture, you don't want to be perceived as any weakness and all this. So guys would come and they'd say, look, I'm suffering from all this stuff, which is what all of us think of when we think of people who overtrain, right? Big surprise, SEALs overtrain, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you run into sleep issues, you run into motivation issues, emotional issues, anxiety issues, body compositions, exercise tolerance, like chronic fatigue, memory, like all this shit. But the one thing that really stood out to me when I was in the SEAL teams, when we called Motrin, that was 800 milligram Motrins that were like
Motrin and water. That's
the orange coated 800 milligram Motrins. We called it Bud's candy or SEAL's candy, right? Because that fixed anything, right? Like your leg is broken, Motrin, whatever. You got herpes, Motrin. Like, it didn't matter. Here you go, take Motrin. So when I got back to the SEAL teams, what I quickly realized is the new candy was Ambien, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like Ambien. I why is there so much Ambien use going on, right? So I started looking around, talking to some people. You know, there were some anecdotal reports from officers over, that were forward deployed, so like 85% of my staff is on Ambien. Like, this seems to be a problem, right?
Wow.
And general medicine was okay with that, right? Like, if you look at your standard Western practice, people can't sleep, you give them a drug to help them sleep. So I'm like, it's probably not the best idea, and it's probably related to some of these other complaints these guys are having.
Right.
But I literally learned nothing about sleep in medical school, nor did any other doctor. Like, if there was a class, it was one class, and I slept through it or something. Like,
that's a couple things I've learned when I talk to doctors is there's like a couple things they don't learn about. One is sleep, and the other one is they don't learn about nutrition either.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You might learn about what vitamins do in the body, but you don't learn like...
Yeah, you learn the biochemistry of that, but you don't learn the application of it. And it was ridiculous, right? I had always educated myself on that, so I was okay with nutrition. Already, I've always sort of followed that scene, but so the sleep, I just said, well, shit, I literally know nothing about sleep. Like, I have no idea, right? So let me pull out the medical literature and start seeing what's the standard of care. What do you do about sleep? How do you diagnose sleep disorder? We're not talking about sleep disorders, really, right? We're talking about guys that don't sleep well. Which is different than, say, something like obstructive sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome. And this is the type of things that medicine deals with. It's disease-based. These guys don't have disease. It's suboptimal performance, right? Suboptimal sleep.
I'd imagine they want to sleep. Are they just too busy to sleep? Is that the problem?
So there's multitude of things going on. So this is how the whole thing unraveled for me. So I look through all this – medical literature, it's like the first thing they say is, well, you teach your patient to relax. I'm like, yeah, that's good.
hey, relax, dude.
Yeah, just relax, you'll be fine. Don't worry about, like, you know, going to combat, people shooting at you, all that. Just relax. Just, you know, loosen your muscles when you do that, it'll be fine. So it's like, teach them to relax. If that doesn't work, then, you know, you do a little bit of sleep hygiene stuff, which is like, you know, tell them to go to bed at the same time and don't eat like a lot of carbohydrates before you go to bed, and like some basic kind of crap like that. They don't really know what they're talking about. Hmm. And then you start giving them drugs, right? First you give them sedatives. If that doesn't work, you give them hypnotics. You know, if that doesn't work, then you give them antipsychotics, right? And you essentially just drug these people into like submission, and you're like, okay, probably not the best idea to give a seal, you know, an antipsychotic, and then say, hey, take this machine gun and go out here and make some really good decisions during combat. Not a good idea. So, and you know, the other problem, of course, is that as a dive medical UMO, undersea medical officer, so as the SEAL's physician, it was my job to say whether or not they were medically qualified to do their job. And most of that's beyond my control. It's not my assessment. It's, you know, big bureaucratic decisions. There's the book. Like, this,
you got to go through this checklist. Yeah. You got to go see these five different docs, and they all got to sign off on you.
Yeah, and if you're on this drug, that's disqualifying.
Right.
If you have this problem, that's disqualifying, right? So right. I can't even give these guys the drugs that they're telling me to give them, even if I wanted to go down that route. So,
So is everyone kind of going away from prescription drugs at that point, and they're all seeking something that's illegal or prescribed by their buddies?
No, so they were actually getting Ambien. Somehow Ambien slipped through the cracks, right? Mm. I don't know
they
how.
They could get that, and that was not on the checklist of things that would disqualify you from.
So gotcha. So it actually is on the checklist that would disqualify you, but for some reason that was completely overlooked, right? So there's a category of drugs that they call psychotropic, right? So if it affects your psyche, it's a psychotropic medication, which is a disqualifying medication unless you get a waiver or clearance for it. Ambien falls into that category, but for some reason they just said, well, you know, that's not really that, and so they just hand it out and it's no problem. So I start looking through this and going, well, how am I going to fix this? Well, the first thing I need to do is figure out what actually happens in order for us to sleep. Like, what makes us go to sleep?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a good answer for that. So, like, I'm literally going back to, like, very basic, like, college-level physiology books and then working my way up. And then I started, working with and consulting and training with functional and integrative medicine docs and all this stuff, right? And that was one of the really cool aspects of my job, is that being a physician for the SEALs, kind of a like a quasi-celebrity status working with the SEALs for these docs, that like they were happy to help, and they didn't consider me a competitor for their functional medicine practice because, right, like, I'm in the military, so like they'll share their information with
you're
me.
You're segregated from the
so
general
they're like,
population.
Yeah, we'll be happy to train you, right? So I started learning all of this. I started learning about all the cascade of events, and then when you start understanding the physiology and what's supposed to happen, then you can go in and you can actually measure some serum and urine. You can even do performance testing, things that I didn't necessarily get into that. I would, you know, I'd farm that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
But you can start looking at markers to say, you know, is this off on this guy? Is this a contributing factor? Things that people have all heard about, like cortisol, right? Cortisol is a major regulator of awake, of alertness, right? Epinephrine, norepinephrine. But interestingly enough, so are all of the androgenic hormones, right? So like testosterone is a huge player. And one of the things that we found with some research in the teams is that there's a great correlation. It's not quite a one-to-one correlation, but there is a great correlation between total testosterone and total time in bed. But you go, whatever, they're SEALs, they're 28 years old. Of course they have testosterone through the roof. So like, that's not the issue, right? But then when you actually test their testosterone, it's like, no, actually he has the testosterone of a 95-year-old guy or a 16-year-old girl, you know, something in that range.
Just the less you sleep, the lower your testosterone
is. So then I start digging into this. I'm like, oh, you know, it looks like in deep sleep, that's when you secrete testosterone. That's when you secrete growth hormone, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. These are anabolic stuff. And this allows you to recover, and this changes your cognition, and this changes your prefrontal cortex, your decision-making abilities. This affects the chronic pain they're complaining about because the inflammation that's occurring if you don't get adequate sleep. And then you start looking at what do sleep drugs do, right? So you look at the Z drugs, they call them, which are essentially... it's like Valium or something, but it works right on a more specific receptor, right? But if you start looking at the sleep studies on these guys, not the studies themselves, but you convert that to something called a polysomnograph, which looks like this very, you know, very linear kind of deal where it tells you what stages of sleep you're in and how long you're in each stage.
Yeah.
Sleep drugs do not allow you to sleep. There's no sleep involved. You're unconscious when you're taking sleep drugs, right? Mm. So you lose your deep sleep, your slow wave sleep cycles.
And that's unconscious and not recovering from exercise or whatever.
You're not producing that testosterone. You're not producing that growth hormone.
Right.
And there's probably some hormones that we don't even know, and there's a lot of hormones tied to those hormones.
Right. So there's all sorts of stuff going on when you start looking at the sleep physiology. Dan Pardee's here, and he's a neurobiologist who knows infinitely more than I do about the neurotransmitter changes with sleep. Excuse me, but all the downstream effects of that is what I was really concentrating on. But we know things like memory consolidation, actually your motor learning. So like if you do jiu-jitsu or you box or you go shoot or something like that, mm-hmm. that muscle memory that you learn, that happens when you're asleep.
Right.
It doesn't happen during that day. It happens when you sleep that night. That's when you consolidate that.
Kind of like when you train.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You don't get stronger when you're training. You get stronger when you're recovering.
So when you take a sleep drug, it looks, and you do a sleep study on that, people are unconscious. So if I hit you in the head with a baseball bat and you fell on the ground, nobody would go, oh, look, you fell asleep. Oh, Mike fell asleep right here, right? They'd be like, he's unconscious. And when we do a study on your brain, it would be like, yeah, he's unconscious. There's no sleep architecture there, right?
Right.
That's what happens with sleep drugs. Some of them, I won't get into all the details in there, but there's minimal stuff in there. So, all of the good stuff that's supposed to happen, all of the anabolic activity happens when you're in deep sleep. So what the metaphor that I use, or I guess the analogy that I use in my lectures, if you look at the cortisol curve, right? That's a good representation sort of what the adrenals are doing. It's an easy hormone to measure that follows, or what are the adrenals doing? And what the adrenals do is they keep you alert in proportion to what's going on in your environment, right?
So at the beginning of the day, you're supposed to have elevated cortisol.
Yeah,
you wake up, you have a boost, and then
the day. Cortisol is actually what's supposed to wake you up.
Right.
Now our alarm clocks wake us up, but that's what should wake you up.
Right. Right.
And if you wake up in the morning and you're laying around on your couch and you're reading a book, there's not a whole lot of adrenal hormones going out there, right? Like you have like this basal level and this is normal. Then somebody kicks in your door with a machine gun, like, and your freaking adrenal hormones go way up because your environment now says you better be really alert.
Yeah,
now,
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. So now you're in fight or flight mode, right? So we know what happens in fight or flight mode. When you're in fight or flight mode, essentially your entire existence depends on this moment, right? So your body optimizes you, makes you superhuman, right? You're stronger, you're faster, you're more coordinated, you have a higher pain threshold, like your lungs dilate, you're taking in tons of oxygen, your pupils dilate, you're taking in tons of peripheral vision, like all your glucose is being mobilized so that your limbs have plenty of energy, neuromuscular coordination is going up, and like you are ready to fight or flee. So that's a great state. So why don't we run around like that all the time, right? Why can't I just be all the time like that? Because then I'd be like this. I'd be Superman, right? Like I'd be always faster, stronger, right? Well, you can't do that because it's energy expensive. Like it takes away from other things. And where what are you taking away from? Well, you're taking away from digestion. You're taking away from right. You're taking all of the blood out of the core here, right? You're sending that out to your limbs. You're shutting down regions of your brain so you'll be more impulsive. You don't want to be thinking when you're in fight or flight. You want to be completely impulsive, right? Completely reactionary. If you stop to think about it, like you're probably going to die, right?
You'd be dead, yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter if you can reproduce. It doesn't matter if you can fight off infection. It doesn't matter if you can repair the damaged tendon. It doesn't matter if you can digest the food in your stomach. Like none of this stuff matters unless you get away from this situation. So all of that goes away. Now, when you're in deep sleep, it's exactly the opposite. You don't need to respond to anything in your environment. You don't need your limbs. You don't need your eyes. You don't need a lot of respiratory volume. You don't need it. Mm-hmm. So it's exactly the opposite. So the exact opposite things happen. your immune system is awesome while you're in deep sleep, right? You're repairing, you're restoring, you're fighting off infection, you're becoming anabolic, you're releasing growth hormone, you're releasing testosterone, you're doing all of these things that are going to allow you to repair and be better. You come up into these other areas of sleep and a lot of the neurocognition stuff comes into play. You're categorizing emotional events that happen during the day. You're consolidating memories. You're putting things together. Like if you've ever taken a college course or something and gone to sleep not knowing something and wake up and the answer's in your head, right? It's you didn't learn anything. You consolidated some ideas.
So like staying up till 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And studying for a test that happens at 8 a.m. Probably not a great idea.
Not a great idea.
Probably better just go to sleep.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So what my guys were missing out on was all of this repair because they were taking Ambien to sleep almost every night. Some of these guys were literally taking 4 or 5 Ambien and a couple of alcoholic drinks and only getting 3 hours of sleep and deciding, well, the solution to that is I'll go into the gym and I'll work out really hard and that'll make me super tired.
Yeah.
And then I'll sleep better tomorrow night. And then you say, well, how long have you been trying that? Well, you know, 5 years, 6 years, like, probably not going to work then, right? Maybe we should adjust the plan, right? It hasn't worked yet.
Right.
So you see this over and over again. And then you do the labs on these guys, and they look like 85-year-old guys with metabolic syndrome.
Right.
But military, heavy bureaucracy, you know, very conservative. They're not ready to talk about hormonal treatment on 28-year-old guys, right?
Yeah.
Like we're not going to let you go muck around with these guys' hormones. And they don't have hormonal disease, right? They don't have, they don't have Addison's disease. They don't have Cushing's disease. They don't have hypogonadism. Like, they don't have these diseases technically. Mm. They're just way, way, way suboptimal, right? So the safe way to talk about this was to talk about sleep.
Gotcha.
So they would let me present on sleep. They would let me lecture, talk to everybody about the sleep. And it worked out great because it gave me a really conservative version of how do I optimize people.
Right.
When I did the functional integrated medical stuff and anti-aging certification and all this stuff, they were just like, boom, give them the drugs and they'll be better. True, but now they have to take the drugs for the rest of their life. Maybe not the best idea for a 30-year-old guy. Say, you're going to have to take testosterone for the next 50 years. Like, let's try some other things first. So, I did these really extensive lab panels that, you know, actually pissed everybody off because they were too expensive and too robust, and I needed to cut these down. And what was I doing? This is voodoo and all this type of stuff. But I found things like, so what I track now, what's more important is free testosterone. Total testosterone really doesn't matter. And I don't know sort of your population, how much people know about all that.
So what's
that,
the difference between free testosterone and total?
So your total testosterone is just essentially we're finding every testosterone molecule that's within a certain volume of your blood, right?
Right.
And it's a density gig. So some of that testosterone, however, is bound, right? So it can be bound, what we call loosely bound, to albumin, or it can be strongly bound, tightly bound, to something called sex hormone binding globulin, which you may have heard of. Now, it's irreversibly bound to sex hormone binding globulin. So that means that testosterone will never be used. It's going to go back to the liver. It's going to be broken down. It's going to be used to make something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
The loosely bound stuff can be mobilized under certain conditions. But the way testosterone works is it actually, and this is true for all hormones, right? All cholesterol-derived hormones, is they just diffuse right through the cell wall, and then they bind a protein inside the cell, and they go into the nucleus of a cell, and they change the DNA expression, and an mRNA comes out, and then that cell changes what it does. Like, it produces more proteins, or produces more receptors, it makes more energy, like whatever that hormone does, that's what happens, right? So it's mainly, this is what we call anabolic, is building, is taking small stuff and building bigger stuff. So when you talk about free testosterone, the free testosterone can get into the cell with no effort. It's just floating around. It goes right into the cell and goes into the nucleus, and it does anabolic activity, and there's no demand signal. Like, you don't need the cell to say, hey, I need testosterone. It just happens, right? Mm. So that's the important number. Now, I would literally see in 25-year-old guys, 30-year-old guys, I would see free testosterone that were in the lowest 10% of the normal range. But if I send these guys to an endocrinologist, they say, well, he's within the normal range. Like, what's the problem, right? I'm like, well, the problem is he has to carry 200 pounds and, you know, jump over walls and kick in doors and like, right, fight guys and shoot people. And like, it probably need a little more testosterone than that. But what I found is that if I got guys to sleep, now I did tons of different interventions, right? But if, and even in the simplest case where all I did was get these guys to sleep naturally and get off of the sleep drugs, which I would do through sleep hygiene, I could do through nutritional changes, I could do by getting them to not do high intensity training 7 days a week, you know, like, right, some sleep hygiene stuff, talk about alcohol, talk about darkening out your rooms, all these things that everybody talks about that are pretty well known now. 5 or 6 years ago, this wasn't like mainstream stuff, oh, yeah, but it's pretty common knowledge now. Get guys to sleep, 300% increase in free testosterone, right? So, wow, so that's a big difference. Sadly, a lot of those guys, that wasn't enough, right? So the 300% now took them up to like average, like, right, like average for all comers.
You don't want a Navy SEAL to have be average in, no, anything, right?
Right. So that's really how I got into this whole world. And then I started doing a lot of lectures around the support groups for NSW. So I started doing a lot of these, and that's where I met Rob Wolf. And he was like this nutrition guy who talks a lot about sleep, and I was his sleep guy who talked quite a bit about nutrition, and we both talked quite a bit about hormones and sort of the anabolic activities and how to optimize performance. And that's what this was all about, was optimizing the performance of the SEAL. Nothing matters to a SEAL more than his performance at his job.
Right.
Like,
right,
it's for 99% of them, I would say that's more important than their relationship with their wife and kids.
Like, yeah, they're obsessed with their job.
It's like, is it. This is how they measure themselves. This is who they are, right? It's their identity.
Yeah, if you underperform, you die.
Yeah. And if you underperform, you look like a shitbag to the guy next to you. Yeah. And that's like the worst thing that can happen to you in the teams, right? Like, if the other team guys don't respect you, you're like, yeah, like that is like hell for a SEAL. That's the worst thing that can happen. So everybody wants to be the highest performing guy they can possibly be. It's a super competitive group. Everybody wants to be. And that's where CrossFit started in the SEAL teams, right? Like, it's a perfect thing. Is like, you bring in like a bunch of 100-pound chicks to beat a bunch of SEALs my size and Fran. And they're listening like, oh shit, we better start doing CrossFit because this 100-pound chicks beat me. Right? So, and it's uber competitive. And so it was all about this performance optimization. And it just kind of kept spiraling. I kept learning more and more. The Navy was still a little too conservative for me to do a whole lot with the guys. You know, I developed over time when I started understanding sleep physiology. The first thing I thought of is vitamin D3. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows about this now. Was not nearly as commonly known in those days. But one of the things that happens, when you work at night and you sleep during the day, and then if you are outside in the day, you're covered in camouflage and body armor and helmets and, you know, like all sorts of stuff, and you're in vehicles, and these guys weren't getting any sun exposure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, all right, well, maybe it's just this vitamin D thing, right? Because if I give them vitamin D, then it should allow this pathway, right? So you guys have all heard of and probably experienced, you eat turkey and you want to take a nap, right?
Absolutely.
Right? And why do you want to take a nap?
Usually eating like potatoes and cranberry sauce.
But
and I'm not at work.
You guys know what's in turkey, right?
Was it tryptophan?
Yeah, tryptophan, right? So the tryptophan coma, they call it, right? Mm. Well, why that pathway works is because when you ingest tryptophan, it accelerates this pathway, right? So what happens is tryptophan becomes something called 5-hydroxytryptophan, which you've seen, right? 5-HTP, you see it on the shelves. It's a calming agent, neurocalming agent for anxiety and so forth. And it's a calming agent because 5-HTP then becomes serotonin. And we know that serotonin is like this mood enhancing thing, right?
People took some 5-HTP last night.
Right. Yeah. So what is, and what do we call people with low serotonin? We call them
sad.
Depressed, right? They're depressed. So we give them drugs to
people we don't hang out with.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And then the serotonin becomes melatonin. And melatonin does a ton of things. Like, it's insane how many things melatonin does. But one of the major things it does is it shuts down your adrenal function, allowing you to be in the opposite of that fight or flight.
right?
So you have to have adequate levels of vitamin D3 to make 5-HTP into serotonin, right? So if you're vitamin D3 deficient, you're probably not sleeping well. You're serotonin deficient.
There's our mood issues, right? You're melatonin deficient, which there's our sleep issues, right? And then there's also, now you're not getting the quality sleep, your inflammatory cascade, your chronic pain, like all this other stuff. So I'm like, all right, I'm brilliant. Like, it's vitamin D3 and we're done, right? So I give them vitamin D3 and it works pretty good. You know, like people are sleeping a little better, but not probably quite there. Then I learn, well, actually every vitamin D3 reaction requires magnesium. Oh, okay. Let's put some magnesium in this formulation. So, you know, break out the natural calm. So added that in there.
Starting to sound like my bedtime ritual.
Yeah. And then you just start backing it up. And you're like, all right, well, let's give them some 5-HTP. Let's give them some tryptophan. Let's, you know, let's give them a little bit of melatonin. Right? And so you, so essentially just by giving all of the substrate, and I always tell people, this is not going to make you make melatonin. What it's going to do is it's going to ensure that you have the materials to do it. I'm bringing the substrate to it. It's like I'm bringing lumber to the construction site, but if there's no crew, it's not going to do anything, right? No. And then vitamin D is the only fat-soluble one of those, so you, that'll get stored, but everything else, you'll just pee out. So if you don't need it, big deal. It just goes away.
Yeah.
And everybody's vitamin D3 deficient, so I didn't care. So I get people to sleep.
There's a baby right there about to pull our plug out there.
So I get people to sleep well. Their total testosterone goes up. Their free testosterone goes up. Their cortisol levels normalize. Their inflammatory markers normalize. Their thyroid normalizes. One of the big things that happens with poor sleep and chronic stress is thyroid dysregulation. You've probably heard of that. Like cortisol interferes with the conversion of T4 to T3.
Yeah.
Thyroid is actually an anabolic hormone, right? So I tell my patients testosterone is like the horsepower of your car, and you know the your thyroid hormone, that you know that's the RPMs, right? That's your drivetrain, right? So you can have a ton of horsepower, but if you're idling, it's still not that great. And you can have a ton of RPMs, but if it's, you know, a 90 horsepower car, you don't have a lot of power. So that's pretty much it. That's how I got to that place. I started doing some over-the-counter stuff to increase testosterone further by zinc citrate, which is an aromatase inhibitor, because the feedback loop to your brain is estrogen. It's Mother Nature's biggest joke, right?
Say zinc.
And zinc citrate specifically because that one just absorbs really well. So if you think of guys with excess body fat, right? There's this estrogen picture of them, right? Estrogenic picture. So one of Mother Nature's biggest jokes is this. So a certain percentage of our testosterone becomes estrogen, right? And then that estrogen has exactly the opposite effect in the nucleus of those cells as the testosterone does, right? So they compete for the same receptors, and it's a completely different effect. Lots of estrogen makes you a woman, and lots of testosterone makes you a man. Right?
So our guys with lots of testosterone could get bitch tits or...
Right.
Yeah.
So what happens...
Gynecomastia.
Yeah. So what happens is you get these high levels of estrogen because the enzyme that does that conversion is in our body fat, right? So if you're getting fatter, you convert more of your testosterone into estrogen. If you're not sleeping well, you're not producing testosterone, you're not producing growth hormone, you're chronically inflamed, you're getting fatter, guaranteed, right? You're getting fatter, which means now you have less testosterone, but because you're fatter, more of that testosterone is going to become estrogen.
Right.
And then the feedback loop to the brain is the estrogen. Your brain knows how much testosterone you have by how much estrogen is hitting your hypothalamus, not the testosterone. So then your estrogen levels go up, tells your brain, oh, we got a ton of testosterone. Let's start shutting down this testosterone production. And then the luteinizing hormone decreases, and you don't stimulate your testicles to make any more testosterone because estrogen's high.
And then you spiral down.
Gets worse, right? Because one of the big drivers of that sex hormone binding globulin I was telling you about, right, is estrogen. So the sex hormone binding globulin goes up. Now you have a lot of your testosterone. You don't have much. What you do have, a lot of it's becoming estrogen. and what testosterone you have is largely bound to sex hormone binding globulin, because this is through the roof. So your androgenic effects.
There's nothing left to build.
And you said it never unbinds. It's stuck there. You can't get it back.
Yeah. And so you can calculate that all out, and it's called the free androgen index. So how much anabolic androgenic activity you're actually getting from your testosterone. These guys, like, none. Like, it just sucked, right? Now, then I talked about the thyroid. Thyroid also affects sex hormone binding globulin. And then chronically elevated cortisol leads to chronically elevated insulin, which also increases sex hormone binding globulin, right? The lower insulin from these guys being like trying to fix themselves with the paleo diets and all that stuff raises sex hormone binding globulin as well. So now these guys are just an absolute wreck. So try to block that. You block the estrogen so you can increase their brain's.
So you're blocking that with zinc.
Blocking that with zinc. Now the brain's saying, well, let's put out more luteinizing hormone, right? Mm-hmm. And then luteinizing hormone's going to tell my testicles to make more testosterone.
Right.
Now, you've heard of when you work out, you get this anabolic effect, right? You get a testosterone surge when you work out. That doesn't come from your brain, right? You're not secreting luteinizing hormone and your testicles aren't like pumping out a bunch of testosterone while you're lifting weights.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening is inside of your cells, DHEA is being converted to testosterone. But only under demand, right? So if you don't exercise intensely, it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys were DHEA deficient, largely because they have adrenal fatigue because of their job, and DHEA comes from the adrenals. So DHEA and zinc, now we've increased, you know, two pathways to producing testosterone, getting them to sleep. We have three pathways. Great anabolic activity. People get better. Their moods get better. Like, all this stuff starts improving. Some of the older guys, like, they've been living this stuff so long, it wasn't enough. You have to do more interventions with them. You know?
Yeah.
The Navy gets really skitsy around, you know, starting to do too many things with that.
Right.
That's essentially, you know, where I came from and you know, the message I preach now. So it's really that, you know, I'm only talking about a few aspects there, but like in my lecture yesterday, I talked about all of the anabolic effects of sleep. The most powerful anabolic activity or tool we have is sleep. Like, if you sleep well, that is the optimal anabolic state. Like, I could give you each 3 grams of testosterone injections per day and not let you sleep, and it's not going to make any difference.
Right.
Like, you're not going to be anabolic. Your performance is still going to suck. So sleep is the key. Like, you have to have all the hormones in place, but sleep does that. And then while you're sleeping, you can actually get bigger, better, faster, stronger, smarter, better looking, all that stuff.
What would you recommend is the right amount of sleep for an athlete that trains 2 hours a day?
Yeah, so...
you know what? Let's take a break real quick, and we'll get back to that question.
Okay.
I'll totally take the day where I should be recovering, and I'll ruin it by going out and drinking tonight.
No.
I definitely did that back in the day a lot.
No ergolytic effects of alcohol whatsoever. I can't think of any here.
Makes me a better dancer. And we're back. We're here with Dr. Parsley talking about sleep, hormones, testosterone, vitamin D, estrogen, all that mess. And so we were just joking around about, you know, I've got a rest day tomorrow. It's some big numbers. Today in the weight room, I should probably go out and pound some beers. Could you tell us why that might not be a great idea?
Well, beers specifically, probably a little worse, right? Because you have, you know, you're going to have the inflammatory issues around the beer, but, you know, alcohol,
right. cider. Yeah. I'll be drinking cider.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, you know, alcohol itself is a reasonably potent, ergolytic agent, right? So like it essentially raises or lowers your pH, your serum pH, right? So when you drink alcohol, you become acidemic, right? So you have acidic blood. Not a great thing, right? Because that's perceived as the same as a bacterial infection or a parasite infection or something. And what that leads to is what? The big cortisol spike. And cortisol is catabolic, not anabolic.
And you don't want a cortisol spike.
No.
And you're right before bed. Because you usually drink and then pass out.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing that happens with your big drinking night is the same thing that happens with Ambien, like we were talking about, right?
Right.
There's no sleep architecture there. You lose all your slow wave sleep cycles, so then you don't actually recover that night. You know, that sleep is pretty much useless. It's unconscious.
That's why I feel worse after a night of drinking than even if I had gotten knocked out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So right before we came back on, I had a question for you about my testosterone is like 465, which is kind of on the lower side of things. And I was saying I get 8 hours of sleep every night. And you started telling me that was more about the quality of my sleep, which you'd already kind of mentioned.
Yeah.
Could you kind of go more into that for everyone that didn't hear that conversation?
Yeah, so it's possible. I mean, everything I'm talking about right now is like a gross oversimplification. There's nothing more complex in medicine than endocrinology and neuroendocrinology. And they start adding into their nutrition and neuropsychological, endocrine axis. It gets insane. Mm-hmm. A couple of things that come to mind. So it could be the quality of your sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
That could be from, I don't know enough about your training regimens, but maybe you're overtraining a little bit, right? So if you're overtraining a little bit, you have excess cortisol, you don't get good quality sleep, that could happen. You could have a depletion of DHEA just because you're essentially DHEA deficient because of whatever reasons, low adrenal function, outperforming sort of your cellular ability.
And as I said earlier, DHEA converts into testosterone. Yeah. So if you don't have enough of that, then it's not going to be converted and you're not going to have enough testosterone.
So when you're working out, your cells want this testosterone. They want the anabolic effect because they're under stress and they want to be anabolic to be able to produce these hormones, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or these proteins. So if you're low on DHEA and you can't do that cellular conversion, it's going to come from your free testosterone, which means it's going to pull more of your serum testosterone out, and that's going to go into your cells. And so then when I measure your serum testosterone, who knows, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing that matters is what time of the day did you get your testosterone tested?
It was probably about 10 o'clock after not eating at all that morning.
Okay. So the testosterone peak is, in the wee hours, like right before you wake up, that's when your testosterone peaks.
Mm-hmm.
So it can fluctuate by about 30 or 40%, during the day. So if you had, say, like a circadian shift, if you'd traveled or if like you'd been off a couple of nights for the way you're working or any type of thing like that, you could actually have 40% higher testosterone if you would have tested at a different time of the day. Mm-hmm. But again, what really matters is the free testosterone and something called DHT, which is the dihydrotestosterone, which is the most anabolic form of it.
Yeah.
So some guys have a huge number of free, right? So you could have a total testosterone of 500, right? Mm-hmm. And with that 500, you could have a free testosterone of 30, or you could have a free testosterone of 120, right? It depends on, how much of it is bound. So that gets into blood protein, it gets into the sex hormone binding thing that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the other thing I mentioned is the quality of your sleep, like how much slow wave sleep cycles are you getting. And that's driven a lot by adenosine. I think you said you work out like once
right now. It's just once a day.
Once a day.
Yeah,
I thought you
every
said,
day.
I thought you said once a week.
I'm not overtraining on once a week.
Yeah, yeah. Once a day, what you're doing, could be a little too much, right? Yeah, I doubt it. You could be
right now. I doubt it.
you could be not doing enough, which also causes the same problem, right? Because one of the major things that pushes us to go to sleep, that's a bit of a misnomer. So there's really no switch. All right, oversimplification.
Right.
Dan, don't let Dan Party hear me say this. there's really no active mechanism to put you to sleep. There's a lack of wakefulness that allows you to fall asleep, hence the language of we fall asleep, you drifted off to sleep. There's not like this clicked and I went to sleep, right?
My wife thinks that happens to me.
Yeah.
Like, you son of a bitch. You fall asleep so fast.
So one of the things that causes what we call sleep pressure, which is your drive to want to go to sleep, is adenosine, right? Adenosine is the byproduct of the breakdown of ATP, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you exercise a lot, you produce a lot of adenosine, you have a lot of sleep pressure. And what we found is that the higher the sleep pressure, the more slow wave sleep cycles you get, right?
Oh.
The longer that is, that's when you produce testosterone and growth hormone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that said, there are some variations in sort of what's normal for the age range, but looking at you, imagine you're in between 19 and 40 years old, and so the average for your age group would be about 720 something for total. So I mean, it's something to investigate, but there, you know, there's lots of little things that could be done, that could be there. You could have a thyroid function being off, like hypothyroidism really messes with testosterone production and performance of testosterone. And that, you know, that's a possibility. So you'd really just need to like get into it. If you wanted to figure out what that was, you'd, you know, need to get the right labs done at the right time, get in with a functional medicine doc, you know, evaluate things in your diet. Like, you know, chronic inflammation crushes testosterone. So if you're eating like inflammatory foods, something that's not quite right for you, which could be anything, right? Like you can really have a food sensitivity to anything, right?
So as far as like practical advice for anyone listening to this that wants to have as much testosterone as possible and as much usable testosterone as possible, like what's like three easy tips you could give them where they could make a change in their daily routine or their training or their nutrition to help have the best possible chance at increasing what they produce already?
Yeah, so I only get three, huh?
Three.
Okay, three things.
If you give me three quick, we'll give you five.
Okay.
More
so,
better.
Yeah, so here you go. Like the first intervention always is sleep, right? So good quality sleep. And that's not sleep with the television on, and that's not sleep with the lights on, and that's not, you know, all of the sleep hygiene stuff, you know, that completely dark room, a cool room, comfortable room, like no electronics in bed, like making sure your melatonin's high by not having a bunch of light going into your eyes, all that. Deep sleep, deep quality sleep.
Like blacking out the curtains, wearing an eye mask or earplugs or anything like that.
All of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Anything that causes you to feel like you were in a coma last night and not asleep, right?
If
anytime you can wake up and go, dude, I think I had a mini death last night. Like that's the best sleep. That's the highest anabolic sleep. So that's my number one intervention. The number two intervention is to get rid of all the inflammatory stuff in your diet, right? Make sure that you're getting adequate amounts of protein and make sure that you're getting adequate amounts of fat, and probably a lot more fat than most people are willing to eat. That's a big issue. And then the supplements would be the next thing I would talk about, right? So block the estradiol production, take some DHEA.
So you would suggest supplementing with DHEA?
Yeah. I would only suggest doing that if you're going to follow it, if you're going to do the labs on it, right? Because you have to make sure you're not going like crazy super physiologic.
So
go get a blood draw.
DHEA is banned by USADA.
Yeah.
So that's something that can make you pop, just so you know.
Yeah. I'd say kind of on par with that, you know, the next thing is just to make sure that you're doing your high intensity training, right? So that whole Tabata principle that came out, and the reason that one cyclist group just crushed the other ones from the deadlifts had nothing to do with the deadlifts, right? It was anaerobic threshold training under high tension that does that conversion we were talking about, right? Not only does that do the DHEA to testosterone production right then, but that intermittent lactic acidemia actually causes growth hormone spikes.
Yeah.
Those growth hormone spikes actually affect, you know, liver functioning, decreases the sex hormone binding globulin, and it makes you build up adenosine, makes you sleep more. So
super lactic heavy workouts help with that?
Yeah, but again, you can't overdo that, or then you build up cortisol and then you reverse everything. So at least once a week, like getting after it to where you feel like you almost killed yourself, right? Like at least once a week, twice a week, probably most people, three times a week, probably not most people, right?
Okay.
And then, you know, keeping everything cool on top of that, like, you know, the stress, reducing the stress levels, and, you know, making sure you're getting good recovery and relaxation and all that stuff.
Taking some D3 and ZMA?
Yeah, I mean, the ZMA is great for your zinc source right there, right? You get, the D3 is always good to improve the sleep quality. Any of the things I mentioned for that, you know, natural calm, you get your magnesium, you get your tryptophan. If you're going to take melatonin, take super, super, super low doses of melatonin.
What would be a low dose?
Two.
So you want like 300 micrograms, right? Ooh. Or like 0.3
it's
milligrams.
It's a lot less than the pills that I got on my bedstand.
So I only
take it like when I get to bed. I'm like, which actually lately I've been sleeping great, but I used to be like, if I get in bed and 10 minutes in, I'm like, I'm not gonna fall asleep. I just pop like a
three milligram
or 3 milligram.
Yeah, it wouldn't be 3 grams, but
no.
So
So if you're using it intermittently, it's not that big of a deal to do that.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
If you're going to, if you say like, put me on an anabolic regimen, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to say sleep supplement every night. Like do this every single night.
So because like melatonin and magnesium and zinc, or zinc's not really part of the sleep, is it?
No, that's not part of the sleep. That's more of the testosterone protection. So we're talking about tryptophan, 5-HTP, magnesium, D3, low doses of melatonin. So your brain, from the time the sun goes down, and that's your cue for your brain to start producing melatonin, right? Sun goes down, light in your eyes goes down, your pineal gland starts secreting something called melatonin. Melatonin shuts down adrenal function. Eventually you feel sleepy, go to sleep. So from the time the sun goes down to the time you get up in the morning, barring electric lighting and all of this other type of stuff, right, you would produce about 300 micrograms of melatonin over the night, right?
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
So if you take 1 milligram, that's right, 3 times more than your brain would ordinarily produce. Mm-hmm. Just like anything else, you're going to desensitize yourself to it, right? You're going to down-regulate the receptors for melatonin.
Right.
And you're also going to shut down your own melatonin production. Your body's a smart machine. If you're getting something from the outside in, why are we going to waste energy making it, right?
Right.
Which is why taking testosterone shuts down your testosterone production. I'm getting it from elsewhere. Why is my body going to bother making it? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It's an energy expenditure that's not necessary. So a super low dose of melatonin, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get, like, you know, I say 8 hours of time in bed. If you're sleeping, if you feel like you can sleep 9 hours, that's cool. If you start kind of getting up in the 9.5, 10 hour, you might want to look into something being wrong. Like maybe there's some obstructive sleep apnea going on there. That could be an issue for you. Maybe one of the reasons you're not getting deep sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, obstructive sleep apnea makes you hypoxic, which then makes you acidemic, which leads to that whole pathway, like the alcohol I talked about. Right. Same type of gig. Mm-hmm. The supplementation with all that stuff every night would ensure that you get the deepest possible sleep that you can get. You're bringing all the substrate there. You don't. When I put people in melatonin, I actually get it from a compounding pharmacy. I actually do all my supplements through a compounding pharmacy so that I know I'm actually getting what I
want. High quality shit.
Yeah. And I get it microdosed and I get it sustained release. So I get anywhere from 200 to 300 micrograms that's released over 12 hours.
Yeah. Right?
So you do something like that and you know, you're banging it out. Like you're going to get some good quality sleep, get your total time in bed of somewhere around 8 hours. Even if you're waking up after 6 hours, stay in bed. Right. Mm-hmm. Eventually, you know, practice your relaxation techniques, progressive muscle relaxation, breathing, whatever kind of chills you out. Mm-hmm. Eventually, you will sleep more and more.
That's actually how I learned to sleep 8 hours. Yeah. I actually got out of the Navy.
Yeah.
And I started working and I was listening to Rob Wolf and he goes, you know, you need to be sleeping 8 hours. And what I did was I just wouldn't let myself get out of bed until I hit that 8 hour mark.
Yeah.
And at first I was like awake for 2 hours going, this is stupid. Yeah. And then after a month, I would sleep for 8 hours and then 9 hours came fairly easy.
Yeah. And like I said, like that's one of the things we know. There's a direct correlation between how much time you sleep and how much testosterone you have. And if your testosterone goes up, you sleep more. And if you sleep more, your testosterone goes up. Like, right. It goes hand in hand. So the total time in bed is the easiest way to do it. You pick a bedtime and you stick with that bedtime, and then you pick a wake time and you stick with that. Like this, and we're talking about people who maybe have difficulties sleeping and staying asleep. Some guys, usually younger guys too, that work out a lot, they can just kind of crash whenever they want to sleep 8, 9 hours. Cool.
No problem.
You know, the American Sleep Academy or Society of Sleep Medicine or something, I can't remember. The consensus about 7.5 hours seems to be the norm of actual sleep. And this is like, you know, registered sleep, like we're actually doing an observed sleep study, which means that probably, 8 hours in bed would lead to about 7.5 hours. Now, if you go 30 minutes each side, 7.5 hours plus or minus half an hour, that encompasses about 95% of everybody we've studied, right? So there's not a whole lot of outliers. You hear about these guys that say, I only need 3 hours of sleep, and then I, you know, can build, you know, build Rome in a day after 3 hours. And we've just never seen that in a lab.
Yeah.
We don't have any objective evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. Mostly talk from what you can tell.
Yeah.
Well, I think people too, you know, they may do that for 3 months.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people talk about, what they're doing. Like, they've been doing it for five years.
Yeah, as though that's their lifestyle,
it's like
right?
the thing they've been trying. You know, I'm doing it this week. And then they talk about it like that's what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, no.
Yeah, I was actually guilty of that like a couple of weeks.
I do it too.
A couple of weeks ago, I was on a...
just in his face. Like,
CTP in the breakfast.
I was being interviewed or doing a lecture or something, and somebody asked me about my workout routine, and I'm like, well, you know, I've been doing kettlebells lately. And I'm like, well, actually, let me clarify that. I did kettlebells yesterday. Like, you know,
yeah. I saw a kettlebell from across the room one time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right. So, you know,
I'm a CrossFitter or a weightlifter, depending on the week you talk to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what guys will find is that if they get the good quality sleep and they get the nutrition in tune, and then they do some reasonable programming around their exercise, like 90% of the time, that's all you need. The biggest problem is getting people to value sleep. I mean, we live in a culture that just doesn't value it. That it's like some sort of a sign of weakness or laziness or something. Like, you're supposed to be out there being productive, getting after it. Time is money. You're wasting money. You're wasting time. You should be out there cranking all the time. What we find, though, is that your performance decreases so much when you deprive yourself of sleep that you're making less money because you're less productive, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And your gains aren't there. You're wasting your time in the gym. You're wasting your time doing your sport or whatever.
And what use is money if you can't have a six pack and get chicks?
Exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
And what use are chicks if you can't get an erection, dude? If you don't sleep, you can't get an erection, right? Actually, one night of short sleep, if you decrease your sleep by 2 hours less than what you need, right? 30% decrease in libido, right? 30 to 40%. So you want sex a third less just because you didn't sleep a couple hours.
So this is kind of how I've learned about sleep to some degree is. You go through sleep cycles, and you cycle through like some deep. You go through that deep phase, and that's when you produce growth hormone and testosterone. And then you go through cycles of that. And so for like, I guess you cycle every 60 to 90 minutes. And so if you can get for every 60 to 90 more minutes you get another sleep cycle, so you get that much more testosterone. So in a 6 hour period, you might get like what, 3 or 4 sleep cycles. Or 4 or 5. So if you get more cycles in, is that what's happening? And if you wake up. Because I wake up with lights,
right?
To try and like wake up during the optimal time of sleep cycle. What's important there?
Yeah. So what happens? Your sleep cycles actually range from about 90 to 120 minutes, right? So from the time you lay down and you're kind of in this pre-sleepy kind of alpha brainwave state, you go down through stage two, you go into your deep sleep cycle. It's the first thing that happens, right? You come out of a deep sleep cycle, and that's your longest cycle, right? That's your longest slow, what we call slow wave sleep cycle, right? That's when the growth hormone and testosterone is secreted. That slow wave sleep cycle is your deep sleep. The first one of those is the longest. And then you have a short period of REM, mm-hmm. and then you drop back down again, mm-hmm. and you do another sleep cycle. That slow wave sleep cycle is shorter.
Oh.
Progressively throughout the night, that gets shorter, REM gets longer. Right, there's this whole idea of dual sleeping where like our ancestors slept in two periods, right? So mm-hmm. we're suspecting
there's a middle something. What is it called? Middle.
I can't,
would get up in the middle of the night and do something for like an hour and then go back to sleep.
Right. So nobody knows for sure, right? But
right.
you know, ancestrally, we know this. There's journaling on this, all this stuff. We know that. What makes sense logically, though, is that you're getting all that anabolic stuff at the beginning of the night, right? And then you're kind of coming out of that. You're staying awake. And this is seasonally dependent, right? The way we evolved, sometimes darkness was 12 hours and sometimes darkness was 8 hours. So like if darkness is 12 hours, you're not going to sleep 12 hours yet all of a sudden.
Right.
So it's going to be broken up. So, you know, the suspicion is that the, you know, slow wave stuff is predominantly at the beginning of the night. And then the stuff at the end, the REM, that's mainly the neurocognitive stuff we're talking about. So now you're talking about executive functioning, your working memory, your reaction time, your problem solving ability, like all of these types of things that make us the smartest guy, like our frontal lobe functioning. And then, you know, consolidating memories, all that type of stuff that's happening in the hippocampus and all of that type of thing. That's all happening, we think, more during REM. And the neurotransmitters are being more replenished during the REM sleep.
Gotcha.
The body's hormones are primarily being fixed during that anabolic period of the slow wave sleep cycle.
So if I want to take a nap in the middle of the day and try to get an anabolic response from that, I'm shooting for 60 to 90 minutes.
Yeah, you want a 90-minute nap, right? Okay. So a nap between 90 minutes and 120 minutes is like a full sleep cycle, right? Mm. Over 120 minutes is just sleep, and it's not a nap anymore, and now you're going to screw with your ability to sleep.
So you could get like two high-quality anabolic sleep cycles in a 24-hour period if you get a nap in the middle of the day and then that first cycle at night.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, if you can sleep 7.5 hours and still take a 90-minute nap in the midday, like you'll get another big luteal surge and higher testosterone and more anabolic activity.
Yeah.
If you don't have time for that, and say like you're a graphic artist, or you know you're something that you do something that requires a lot of creativity.
Yeah.
A 20-minute nap restores creativity pretty well.
Yeah, that's right? What I've heard.
Somewhere around a 30 to 45-minute nap will restore executive functioning pretty well. So,
okay.
Like, you can't, like, you know, you're just burned out on, like, whatever work you're doing. Cognitive kind of work is just, like, it's not...
Making decisions.
Yeah, it's not working anymore. Right. I can't make decisions. I can't read. I'm not absorbing what I'm learning, whatever. 30 to 45-minute nap, great. You're probably set. You're gonna recoup a lot of function. You want to just say, hey, I want to be better at everything. Like, I need to be more alert, yeah, more attentive, more creative, and I'm going to get after it. Like 3 hours from now, I'm going to go get after it in the gym. A 90-minute nap is the way to go. Right?
Perfect.
You'll get a full sleep cycle.
All right, now I got to ask this question for those folks in California, Washington, Colorado. So if you smoke weed right before you go to bed, what does that effect have?
So marijuana works on a couple of different pathways that help with sleep. So it works on serotonin, which we talked about, serotonin becoming melatonin. Serotonin is also sort of a calming agent. It also works on GABA receptors, just like benzodiazepines like Valium and the sleep drugs do. It has some dopamine effects as well, which is some mood issues, but also dopamine affects some of the neurotransmitters. Marijuana actually has the most normal sleep architecture of any sort of drug that you're going to use to help yourself sleep. Now, with that said, it's not my recommendation to use marijuana as your first choice, but as your last resort, if you need like a sleep aid that, like, I've done everything I can
possibly
do.
So you're doing the 5-HTP, melatonin,
you've done
and now you're still like kind of on edge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if it's anxiety related or, you know, edginess,
sure,
then I say, you know, you work through all that.
You need to deal with those problems.
You do heart rate variability training, right. You do biofeedback, yeah, like you do everything else. But, you know, pharmaceuticals, and I throw marijuana in pharmaceutical realm.
Yeah.
I mean, it just is, you know, Marinol's of a pharmaceutical version of that. It ironically doesn't work at all.
Gotta smoke it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, you don't actually have to smoke it, right? Like you can eat it. You can use tinctures on the stuff. Like you can rub it on your skin. Like there's lots of ways to get marijuana in, but you know, what they did when they made Marinol is they extracted, like what we always do in science is we're like, well, this huge thing works, but it's only this little piece that matters. So let's take that one thing out and put it in here. And that wasn't right.
And they totally fuck it up.
It turned out that we have a lot of cannabinoid receptors, and like Marinol was just like one, right? And it didn't really do the job. But yeah, I mean, as sort of your last resort pharmaceutical intervention, marijuana is probably better than anything else. Like it's better than alcohol, it's better than Z drugs, it's better than sedatives, hypnotics,
better than Ambien and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's better than all that stuff. Yeah.
You heard it from the doc.
Yeah.
Go smoke some weed. No, I'm just kidding.
There goes my medical license. So maybe you guys can hire me.
You'll have to move out to California.
Yeah. Well, I actually live in California, so it's not a problem.
There you go.
It wouldn't be a problem for me right now if I wanted to do that route.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. That was a lot of helpful information. I think people are going to love it.
All right. Cool.
Got anything you want to plug? Blog or you got anything going on where people should check you out? More information?
No. You know, I've been 1 month away from launching my ebook for the last year.
I know what that's like. Yeah.
You know, I've finally hired some help, so that should be coming out pretty soon. I have a website fully developed and ready to launch. It's you know, some corporate and tax structure stuff that I'm holding up on. So within the next few weeks, you know, check it out, docparsley.com.
Doc Parsley?
Doc, it's DOC. DocParsley.com. I give it away. I'm giving away the free first chapter of the ebook for free. People to check it out. Doing some blogging, doing some information products, and that. And then I'm actually close to what I talked about with the sleep supplement for you guys. There's some variations of that. But I'm launching like sort of a powdered version of that. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Cool.
What was the title of the ebook?
The ebook is just called Optimize Your Sleep, kind of a lame name, but...
No, I think it's great.
Yeah.
All right, guys, make sure you go to barbellshrug.com, sign up for the newsletter, and we'll notify you whenever we post up these podcasts.
Thanks, Kirk.
All right, cool. Thanks.